and welcome to the Tyndale House podcast. Today's episode is one of a number of standalone episodes we'll be doing where we will interview readers and staff from Tyndale House, as well as scholars who we have links with, and we'll be hearing about the research that they're doing and its relevance for the wider church. In today's episode, Peter Williams, Principal of Tyndale House, is interviewed by Tony Watkins, Fellow for Public Engagement at Tyndale House. Peter shares how he got into biblical scholarship, his role within Tyndale House, and the vision and mission for the wider organisation.
Good morning, Peter. Good to have you with us. You're always with us, but it's particularly good to have you with us on the podcast today. So, Peter, you're the principal, which means you run the place. We'll come back to that in a little while. What does that involve and what do we do here at Tyndale House? But let's talk about the how you got to this point. What's your journey in the academic world and, how did you get here?
I grew up in the north of England in a school where you could learn Latin and also Greek, and I was also in a Christian family. And found that I was doing okay at these subjects and not so well in other subjects. And so I thought, how can that be useful? And I was very interested in, from about the age of 16, being a Bible translator. So I actually went to university, to Cambridge here, and did my undergrad degree in Greek and Latin and Hebrew and Aramaic. So those were my four languages I did over four years. That gave me quite a basis in the languages. And also, I think during that time, I felt a call to get further training that would have been useful for Bible translation. So I did a master's and a PhD. And it was during that time I really saw the need for Bible scholarship, which was going to seek to edify and build up the church. And so that's where I had that sense of calling.
Right. So was it during the master's or the PhD where you shifted from thinking about being a translator to a scholar?
It was gradual. So I certainly know during the one of the reasons for doing the PhD in the area I did was advice from people who were involved in Bible translation about the sort of needs that they had. But certainly by the time I was at the end of that, I was convinced that there was work to do close to home.
So what was your PhD?
So it was on the syntax or grammar of the translation of 1 Kings from Hebrew into Syriac, which is Eastern Aramaic. So it's quite abstruse. And I did particularly choose this topic because when I looked in the bibliography of the Syriac Old Testament, it was the book which had the least about it. So the longest piece of secondary literature I had to read was 50 pages. And so I could spend all my time just delighting in reading old stuff. And that's what I was able to do.
So you didn't have much of a chapter of a literature review in your thesis then?
That was great. And the second longest piece was 3 pages.
Oh, wow. That's quite unusual to have such a small amount of secondary literature.
I mean, the problem is if you choose something that's, if I can say so irrelevant and abstruse, the danger is it's irrelevant and abstruse. Right. But then I feel for starting off on a PhD, knowing no one's going to read it, this is really about training you. Okay. That's really helpful. And I often encourage people towards less immediately applicable PhD topics because I think that will actually help them get the skills which will be more applicable later.
Okay, right. So how did it train you? What came out of it for you?
Yes, you spend a lot of time reading ancient texts. Already in my master's degree, I'd read the Old Testament in Hebrew. I think I'd read the New Testament in Greek before I began my first degree, and I was able to work through the Bible in the Old Testament in Greek and in Latin and Syriac and so on. And so seeing all the different ways that things can be translated, the nuances, studying, training yourself to look carefully at a word and slight shifts of meaning, that's all incredibly helpful later on when you're just reading any text.
Sure. So after the PhD? With this specialist knowledge in
So I had a 1-year postdoctoral position in the Faculty of Divinity here, studying words. It was something called the Semantics of Ancient Hebrew Database, and we were I was assigned words for weapons in Hebrew and words for salvation. And then I had a 5-year position here at Tyndale House, research fellow in Old Testament, also doing some teaching in the faculty of what's now Asian and Middle Eastern Studies, teaching Hebrew and Aramaic there.
So who was leading Tyndale? Bruce Winter,
Bruce Winter was the warden at the time. Yeah. And then that came to an end, and wasn't sure quite what to do, but there was a temporary post coming up in Aberdeen in New Testament, and I'd been working a bit on New Testament on the side, and so I applied for that and was actually made permanent once I got there. I mean, there are reasons why I looked very employable for a short time. It's this artificial system we have in the UK where universities are measured by the publications they have in a particular period, and right at 2003, I looked great because my PhD publication had been delayed by 4 years into that period when which was being assessed, and it all was great fun. I got to be a senior lecturer there in New Testament, teaching alongside Howard Marshall coming out of retirement, all sorts of fun things like that. And then, yes, came here when I was 36.
Right. Did that feel quite a shift? I mean, you said you were beginning to do some New Testament work, but you've been doing your PhD work in Old Testament. Mm. That's quite a move to go teaching New Testament.
So it can seem like a very big shift, but it was nevertheless gradual. So my first published book was my PhD on the Syriac of First Kings. My second was on the Syriac of the Gospels. I began noticing that the Nestle-Aland Greek New Testament 27th edition had lots of errors in the Syriac, and I wrote a book all about this. So I'd been working on the Gospels for a few years, and I wrote a very honest application letter, which said, I can teach the Gospels and I'm prepared to do the work to teach Paul. And they took me on that basis. So.
Right. Okay, very good. Do you see yourself as an Old Testament scholar or a New Testament scholar now, or do you see yourself as a Bible scholar?
I see myself as a Bible scholar, and I don't know if it's a real word, a bibliologist, someone who studies how we got the Bible, I suppose.
Right.
Very interested in those sort of language, translation, text questions.
Okay. So tell us about the move from Aberdeen down to come back to Tyndale House in the new
role. I was very happy in Aberdeen, loved it, you know, had tenure, and would have been happy to stay there. But I was encouraged by Howard Marshall, who's a very senior New Testament scholar up there, to apply. And so I did, and I took it. If I was offered the job, it would be a good thing.
Right.
I think if I'd known more about accounts and running an organization, I would have been more scared of the job, because in fact, we were doing very badly financially at the time. And if I'd understood just how bad that was, I might have been scared away. But anyway, thankfully, my ignorance was bliss for a while.
Did you think it was primarily an academic role or a managing role or a...
I didn't think of it in quite those binary terms. I mean, I think that Tyndale House has a role, some sense, steering or a rudder or a flagship, I don't know which metaphor we want to use, within the evangelical movement, being serious about Scripture and studying Scripture at an academic level. And it really is seeking to cheerlead and encourage those who are called to biblical scholarship, and also to call other people to that. And so I think it can have a big influence. I didn't want to see it just drift. But yes, it's very hard work when you are working outside the public sector, where the money just seems to come instantly from government taxation. It's all you have to seek to make things work. You have to find people who are going to support it, which at first, when you're almost unknown, is very, very difficult indeed.
I imagine that quite a few people listening to this won't actually know very much about Tyndale House at all. They've listened to our first series on Trust in the Gospels, but so Tyndale House has been going since 1945. The idea was circulating among some senior evangelicals in the UK in the late 30s. Can you just fill us in a little bit of the history?
The property is purchased in 1944 before D-Day, where people have a vision to set up an institute which is going to help foster evangelical scholars. And at first, it's just one house. Now we're six buildings and, an extensive library. And I guess it's what we might call mentoring today, not trying to give people qualifications. It's trying to help people while they do qualifications and beyond that or before that to be connected with one another. And what therefore happens from here is a whole range of things, from people meeting, planning books, later on giving each other jobs, coming up with ideas, and even organizations. And so it really is a melting pot, if you like, where if you can imagine, as we now have, let's say 50 Bible geeks who are very Jesus freaks, if you put it like that. They might not all want to describe themselves as that, but that's how some people would see them. But, yeah. but when those people get together, a huge amount of things just come from that. Mm. And someone who comes, let's say they come from South America, instantly gets connected with people in Asia, Australia, Europe, Africa, because they're here together. So that's a big thing that's going on. We have housing, we have the UK's largest library of the Bible, we have our own research projects, and we have communications. We go out and speak, and so we've got upcoming conferences where we'll be looking to encourage lay people to go deeper with their Bible understanding. So all of those sort of things can come out of having the center here.
Yeah. Some people might look at all that and say, you're trying to help scholars, you're trying to do research, you're trying to help the people in the church, you're trying to reach out beyond the church, and say that's quite a wide range of things to do. So how does all that tie together? What is the overall vision of Tyndale House?
What ties it together and the unity is depth of scripture study. So that's what everyone's involved in. But from that, of course, that will go into Bible footnotes, which will be available to be read by tens of millions of people. Whether they actually do look down at the bottom is another question. And it will also be reflected in articles that may only be read by 20 people. So all of that has the same information quality need. And you have to, within a movement, and we would see ourselves as evangelical Christians with an open door. So there's all sorts of other people are welcome in here, but this is what we stand for and we're trying to foster. And so the health of the movement is reflected in how deep we are going with scripture.
Hmm. And is that why we have, say, the Old Testament project looking at names? It's going very yep. deep into quite a small area, really. Yep. It doesn't seem for many people immediately applicable. We've got a series yep. coming up on names in the Bible, and I think people, when they listen to that, are going to hear how much interesting stuff there is. But what's the thinking behind having a project like that?
Well, I think one of the biggest political and pastoral and personal challenges we have now is quality of information. Like, what is quality information? Because what we have with our mobile phones is this machine which can give you so much seeming information, but a lot of it may be misinformation. And the only way to discern that is with discerning people. And so it's very important for a healthy movement to have lots of people and a whole ecosystem of people who are trained to discern what is true from what's false, or what's somewhat true, and all those sorts of things. So that's where we need to raise up people. So I feel even with our projects, one of the key outcomes of that is just training people further. Hmm. But also a healthy movement needs to be looking at the very raw ingredients. So as with food, the very best people with food do their ingredients absolutely from fresh, from the primary elements. Hmm. And it's exactly the same with knowledge. Hmm. That we need to be getting to bedrock with those more empirical type study things. Obviously, you need to bear in mind the big philosophical questions as well, which can affect the way you even view data. Mm-hmm. But it's very important to be doing that. So what we have in this case is a big project, which is gathering names from the ancient world, from the cultures that surround the Bible, and looking to compare what we have in the Old Testament with those. And that is brand new work. So I think it's important for any healthy movement to have primary research, not just to be getting information secondarily. And I would say has a lot of relevance for pastors, because pastors, the whole idea of a pastor is they're a shepherd, and a shepherd is a food specialist. They take their sheep to good pasturage, and that's where you have to, a pastor needs to think of themselves as also in some way an information quality specialist. Mm-hmm. So therefore, hopefully scholars connected with pastors, humbly seeking to serve them, can actually help those pastors do their job.
And that's always struck me as being so much at the heart of Tyndale. I started coming here just for day visits back in 2014. And everybody I met on any of my visits, you know, whatever level of scholarship they were involved with, they saw themselves as serving the church and serving pastors. Some of them were pastors, and some of the people we have here are pastors and scholars. So that is absolutely right at the heart of what we do. Tell us about the New Testament projects as well. You've said a bit about the Old Testament one.
Yeah, so there we have the Tyndalehouse Greek New Testament, where we've edited the Greek New Testament, and our aim is to present as accurate as possible to the very letter what we can, the Greek New Testament as it was originally given. We're also concerned about having paragraphs which reflect the earliest understandings of the early church. And again, that's about an incredibly important data set and giving people access to that. So it's freely available electronically online. And we're working on a second edition of that to make sure we can just get that as accurate as possible. Again, it's not that these are going to be a significant number of translatable differences. So whichever Greek New Testament you use, if you translate them into English or Spanish, they're going to come across roughly the same. Right. But when something matters that much, then I think we should have a focus on that. And if you think of the evangelical movement as a whole, global movement, hundreds of millions of people involved, our research and development budget is tiny. So in terms of the actual research that we're doing on this primary set of texts that we say matters, it's not overly luxurious, you know, to have a few people set aside to spend their time just studying this.
Sure. Where do you see Tyndalehouse going in the next few years?
Well, I think we're going to stay in Cambridge.
Oh, good.
And what we're looking to do is get more involved in equipping people from the majority world. Now, this is something that has to be done carefully, because what we don't want to do is export our biases. Mm. But I think there are opportunities to connect the youth of the church and the numerical growth of the church in so many areas where, say, in Africa, the average age is 10 years younger than in Europe on the whole. And there's explosive growth of the church. And then there are, if you like, legacy resources here. Here we have an amazing library. How can we connect the personnel resources in some parts of the global church with what we have? And that's where we need to come to people and seek to serve them and recognize that what's going on is, if you like, mission from everywhere to everywhere. Yeah, now
absolutely.
And what's our role in that? And we're passionate about people having really good skills in biblical languages and manuscripts and so on, and we can teach that and offer that to people. So I think particularly bringing in people here for short periods, I mean 1 to 3 months, which are not taking them out of their ministry context, out of their family, and giving them everything we can intensively, is a way that we can do that.
Mm, yeah, that's great. And how do we benefit from people coming from majority world context to spend time here?
Just the questions people ask, I think, can be incredibly helpful. The perspectives people have, the blind spots that we have. So I think it's very enriching when you have people from six continents together studying scripture. And so we certainly look to be very international. And I think we'll also spend more time on the road. So taking what we can of Tyndale House on the road to people is another thing.
Yeah, sure. So now, as well as running, leading the organization, you've written a couple of books in the last few years. Can We Trust the Gospels was your first popular level book, yep. I think. And of course, that relates to the series that we've just had on the podcast of Trusting the Gospels. What particularly struck you while you were working on that? Were there things that you came across that you were surprised by? Were there things that you wrote about that you thought, this is so important, why do we not talk about this more?
Well, although, I mean, writing it up happened over a few months, I began writing it 20 years before I published it. And I was thinking about it for all of that time, and as I was giving talks in places, I was developing the ideas. In fact, my daughter, when she read the book, said, "Dad, this is just all your talks put together." And yes, I have to admit, there's a lot of truth behind that. But obviously, the discipline of writing it down, you do have to crystallize things that wouldn't necessarily crystallize in a talk. So I suppose I saw a gap. I liked the book F.F. Bruce, New Testament Documents, Are They Reliable? But it was quite old.
Yeah.
And I wanted to do something a bit like that, but different. Mm-hmm. So it does actually get to the person of Jesus at the end, which I think is important. And mm-hmm. I thought, let's just focus around the Gospels mm-hmm. rather than mm-hmm. In the rest of the New Testament. And I had seen a number, I use just three texts, classical texts, which talk about Jesus rather than a whole load of them, because I think sometimes people multiply these texts, but the quality of what they show isn't very high. Hmm. And I've been really struck also by Richard Borkham's arguments about personal names, and I thought there's something that could be done with those. But as I considered that sort of argument, it struck me that it's really not just about personal names, it's about knowledge of everything.
Right.
The argument is that the gospel writers really do know the time and place they're writing about because they're giving people the right sort of names. Hmm. And it struck me an obvious thing is to extend this to geography. And then I realized that really you can derive a lot of knowledge about who the gospel writers must have been just from everything they know, all the plain stuff on the text. Right. So Jesus coming down the Mount of Olives, just the very fact that there is a Mount of Olives that you can come down shows you something about the writer's knowledge. And you start asking, well, who knows that? Well, obviously, lots of people knew that because lots of people went to Jerusalem, but there were lots of people who wouldn't know that because they'd never been.
Right.
And so when you start putting that together, you build up a picture of who these writers are, and you realize that they do have to be really quite close to the events when you look at what they know about coinage, geography, and so on. So that became the largest chapter. There were other things. The most original chapter is actually the one on the text of the New Testament, because I'd done primary research in that, where I came to see that you can take various philosophical approaches to how you establish the text. It won't make that much difference when it comes to the Gospels. And so there's a sort of bottom line there about how you can be confident of the text you read in the Gospels. So those were various things coming together. But above all, I wanted it to be a short book. I there are longer books. I mean, wonderful volume by Craig Blomberg on the reliability of the Gospels that, in fact, came out of research done here at Tyndale House. And that's great. More aimed at seminary students, I wanted something that could be given away to people who are just looking at this for the first time.
Yes. I heard somebody talk about a short book the other day describing it as mercifully short, which I thought that's slightly double-edged, because are you suggesting that I really couldn't have endured this much more? But actually, your books, they're so well written that they're usefully short, not mercifully short.
Yeah, and I do. I mean, I read them out loud and have other people read them out loud to try and make sure that they actually flow, because writing prose that flows naturally doesn't come naturally to me and to most other scholars I know.
Yeah, that's a very good discipline. Yeah. Tell us about The Surprising Genius of Jesus, which was published just last year by Crossway.
Yeah, so that came out of, I mean, I've been traveling a lot, and I'd often do Luke chapter 15, often called the parable of the prodigal son. I would do that as an interactive Bible study. And as I was doing that over a number of years, again, I was seeing things and gradually seeing a lot of depth there. Ken Bailey has pointed out the parallels between that story and the story of Jacob and Esau. But I began to see this right across Genesis, and sort of systematically across Genesis, that story was echoing this and seeing some of those same patterns in Jesus' other teaching. And I just wanted to write that up. And I started writing the book, not sure how long it would be. And then when it got to just shorter than Can We Trust the Gospel, I thought, I think we can finish here.
Right.
We did. And I've been surprised in some ways at the take-up of that, because it's a gentle opening, because it's about a story. And everyone likes a story. And so I think it's one of those things that people can give to someone who's never inquired about the Christian faith before, as well as the fact that it's somewhat demanding in Bible study. I mean, it's a short book with, 9 or 10 pages of scripture index at the end.
Right.
Yes, there's a lot of references in there.
Yeah, short, but deep and accessible at the same time. And that's
what I tried to do. Yeah.
That's quite a challenge to be able to pull off that combination, I think.
Yes, I think part of it is having a focus on the idea of someone who, your reader, as someone who wants to learn. So don't bamboozle them with terminology, introduce them to a subject, but then don't underestimate how far they can go if you guide them. And so that's what I would try to write for.
Yeah, great. Great. Well, thank you very much, Peter. It's been good to chat to you. And I'm sure we'll interview you again for a future podcast when things have developed a bit more in Tyndale House.
I look forward to that.
Great. Thanks. Bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Tyndale House podcast. Our next episode will be the first in a series of 5 episodes on challenging aspects of the Old Testament. In the series, Dr. Andrew Ollerton of the Bible Society meets with 5 researchers to ask how they read, wrestle with, and still really enjoy the Old Testament text. The series is a re-release of the Reading the Old Testament series that was produced in collaboration between Tyndale House and the Bible Society in 2022. Please subscribe to the Tyndale House podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts so you don't miss later episodes. It really helps others to find this podcast if you pass it on to your friends and colleagues, and if you rate and review it.